The second story I'll tell you is about how you go from whiskers to consciousness, so to speak, or
great,
to mind,
yeah,
to mind-body problem. The world is high-dimensional, the brain is high-dimensional, but the connection between them is a bottleneck. And we use this bottleneck to track the dynamics of perception. So what happens? You went up and up and up in the brain W ladder from the sensory organ, the brainstem, thalamus, cortex, and the next level is the ear again. The next level up is the ear again. This is the strange loop of Hofstetter and Escher. So you get back to the same physical point, but you are more advanced in the mental domain.
This is Brain Inspired, powered by The Transmitter.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Paul. This is Brain Inspired. Today I have with me Ehud Achesar. Ehud runs the Achesar Lab at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, where he studies neuronal and behavioral mechanisms of perception. Ehud sees perception as a closed-loop process in which organisms actively generate the sensory signals that they interpret. Today, we discuss his development of an idea that came out of that work about how this kind of processing can account for our conscious experience. It is a type of dualism Ehud calls perceptual dualism, which is different than the dualisms that you may already know. I will use his own words here to summarize it briefly. Quote, "The idea is that humans inevitably experience the world through two fundamentally different modes, digital brain-brain communication and analog brain-world interaction. In this view, the mind and consciousness emerge as social-like phenomena, in the philosophical sense, grounded in brain-brain communication while constrained by brain-world interaction." Simple, right? It'll make more sense throughout our discussion and in a paper that I link to in the show notes as well. But for now, take note of the term brain-brain, shortened as BB, and the term brain world, shortened as BW, because throughout our discussion, you'll often hear just BB and or BW to refer to those two distinct domains. So we discuss the ins and outs of his ideas, how he came to them via studying active sensing in rodent whisker neurophysiology, how the brain implements this dualism via nested loops of neural circuitry that oppose and interlace with each other at multiple levels, and the idea that attractors, in the dynamical sense of the term attractor, may be the corresponding brain signatures of the digital phenomena that belong to the brain-brain or BB mode of cognition. Like I said, he explains this in much more depth in his paper in Psychological Review, which I link to in the show notes. Those show notes are at braininspired.co/podcast/237. Okay, hopefully that's enough of a little nugget to orient you to this otherwise vast expanse of ideas and historical context, some of which we discuss here. So hang on to your hats and refer to the manuscript when you're done. Thanks for being here. I hope you're well. Enjoy Ehud. Ehud, you were just telling me that you've come full circle and now you're a full philosopher. Do I have that right? No, we were just kind of talking about what we're going to talk about, and you were giving me a little bit of your background, kind of where you came from, and you wanted to make a disclaimer that you're not a philosopher.
Yes, yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, so just to make clear that I was not trained as a philosopher, nor as a social scientist. But I do borrow terms and concepts from these fields when it helps me think about perception.
Yeah.
So this is the disclaimer. And everything I say, of course, is an hypothesis, even if I say it very strongly. You know, these are hypotheses that should be debated, should be questioned, and hopefully tested.
I really like that disclaimer. I mean, because I sort of assume that usually, and I get in trouble because people tell me I'm very opinionated and have a strong opinion about things. And to me, it's everything's up for grabs. So everything I say is like, well, maybe.
Exactly.
You know, but
exactly. Yeah. What I say.
All right. Well, you know it's serious when you're dropping Descartes and Plato and in the first few paragraphs of a manuscript. So, okay. So we'll get into your background a little bit, but where I thought we might start is just almost the conclusion or the super big, super high level place where you end up, and that's that you. Let me see. I'll make a statement, and you can correct me. Okay. So one statement is that you haven't solved the mind-body problem, but you've added a new kind of dualism to the mix, to some previous kinds of dualisms that may help reorient to particular processes in the brain and mind where we should look for a solution to the mind-body problem.
Correct. Yeah, this is pretty accurate. And I would add to it that a dualism does solve the mind-body problem.
So if you're a solution, that's right.
Yeah, it's a solution because it's a dualism. So any dualistic theory is a solution to the problem. It does say, you know, I don't have to explain to you how one emerges from the other because they are not reducible to each other. But you do have to explain the interaction. This is the problem for the dualist. But the mind world, the heart problem, for example, which is an example of how materialists are attacked for explanation, is so the question is, how can you explain my subjective experience? A question that comes to a materialist is not a question to a dualist. He doesn't have to explain these things. The question is, where does put the border and how these two dualistic domains interact with each other? And this we try to address.
Well, we're using the term explanation, but does dualism do away with the ability to provide a scientific explanation the way we think of scientific explanations? It is an explanation, but is it scientific?
So our dualistic approach does, I think. Not every dualistic approach gives a scientific explanation, but
okay,
yeah. We do.
We'll get more into that. So, yeah. All right. Well, I was thinking of naming this episode "From Whiskers to Consciousness" or something of that sort. given your background. So, all right. So I stated what we're gonna like the really high level thing, but maybe just kind of quickly give us a sense of where you came from, because you come from an empirical approach, studying whiskers in rodents. And so tell us just how you came to this. And then you don't need to give the whole full scientific background, but just sort of the approach that you've taken. Yeah.
Okay. I'll tell you, okay. The two episodes. So one, as I said, I'm an engineer and neuroscientist, and I'm actually a converted engineer. So I started my career as an engineer. And then was converted to be a basic scientist. And I was an electrical engineer building computers. And I knew with my friends that the minute that we, you know, deliver the product out, it's not the best we could do. And in 2 years, it becomes obsolete. While when you look at the brain, you know, this thing is always up to date, is always, you know, keep itself on top of things. And I was fascinated with it. And at the time that I was kind of got bored, you should say, from engineering and was excited by the brain, I decided to move on and become a neuroscientist. The story is actually interesting because I was taking a management course, and the management course was management by goals. You know, they taught us, take a piece of paper, write on top your goal, at the bottom where you are. And I went home and wrote study about the brain, two arrows in Israel abroad, and got to the bottom of the brain there of the page and said to myself, okay, how do I start? And I knew nothing about science at that time. I went to the nearest hospital, looked for people who could tell me, okay, what is brain sciences? And it took me 2-3 days to find a guy, which is a good friend of mine until today, who opened the field for me and told me, okay, look, here are the labs. This is how we do it. And indeed, I went in Israel and screened, you know, some, I don't know, about 10 labs, found the best place for me. and started.
How did you do
PhD
that? You would just show up and or you would up, email
telephones,
people
and, telephones and yeah. show up and turn out. And he was right telling me, look, every lab will love to have electrical engineer in the lab. Don't worry, everybody will want you. This was true. And indeed, after, you know, completing all the gaps, my PhD was on plasticity, on the topic that was fascinating me. Then when I opened my own lab at the Weizmann, I continued the plasticity as one track, and the other one was perception. The two talk to each other. I think perception came up clearer to me. It was actually, it followed a kind of a sidekick discovery in my PhD, where I followed plasticity, but found beautiful cells oscillating in the cortex. It happened to be the somatosensory cortex. And for that, you know, I remember the moment that I drove to Be'er Sheva in my car, and I tried to understand what the heck these oscillatory neurons, how could they help figuring out the tactile structure of anything. And I remember myself, you know, palpating the dashboard.
This is why you're driving, you said? You remember the drive? What year was this?
Yeah, I was driving and, you know, palpating the dashboard just to feel the texture, etc. And it came to me that, you know, this was my first kind of incident with active sensing, so to speak. You know when you perceive something, you know yourself that it is active. It's clearer with touch. It's less clear with vision. We'll talk about it. But with touch, it's clear that you have to move. You have to act in order to perceive. And once I realized that, the connection with the, so you have time in your movement, right? You induce time. Your speed actually determine the timing of the events, using your finger. And this is where the cortical oscillations could came in as kind of a temporal ruler and interpret the modulations of these timings in order to decode. This was the beginning of my theoretical thinking about perception, which was active, which was borrowed from engineering. And this I took to my lab when I opened the lab to guide my research in perception. And so, the story that we are talking about is more the follow-up of perception rather than plasticity, although it is involved. But in perception, when I opened my lab and my PhD was in monkeys, behaving monkeys, when I moved to this temporal coding, active sensing study, the Whisker system came up as, you know, the best user-friendly, you might call it, system to work on this system. It's very clearly active. You see the whiskers, you know, it's the movement is very rhythmic, unlike primate movement of fingers, which is, you know, stochastic. And the system was known. People, it was kind of captured. The scientific community of whiskers, barrel cortex studying was very intensive. And so this is entry point to whisking. This is why whisking became my referred system to work on perception.
See, this is great because you came in with a question, right? And you were looking for a place to how to approach that question and start answering it, which is
yes,
what you're supposed to do, but not what many people end up doing. They grow up in a lab, quote unquote, grow up in a lab, and that lab is asking a kind of question, and they get used to working, for example, with monkeys or whatever organism they're working with, and they kind of continue on that and just kind of continue on that thing. So this is kind of a beautiful way of yes. Beginning your trajectory there.
Yeah, I liked it also. the fact that I come with a model, like I have a starting point. So whenever I come to judge new data or look at others' data, I have some reference to judge with. And then what is, so the second story I'll tell you is about how you go from whiskers to consciousness, so to speak, or to mind-body problem. And this indeed starts, so it was all empirical part. And my empirical path was, I can describe it as going, basically starting to answer in these questions at the high levels. You know, like everybody, I thought, you know, opening textbooks, that the brain wisdom starts at the cortex, at the cortical level. Okay, you must look for it at the cortex. You go to the cortex and look for it. And I couldn't find it there. Or to say it otherwise, I could find too many explanations to what I see in the cortex. And then I started going down to the thalamus. Things clarified better. Down to the brainstem, they clarified better. I saw that there are two pathways, at least in the Wiskan system, at least two pathways. One is more spatial, one is more temporal. But the picture was clarified only when I got to the very end, the sensory organ. This was the follicle of these whiskers, recording for the very first receptors. Then we saw the light in the lab, so to speak. And the light was again this active sensing. So, you know, you might say, look, you forgot what you already knew, or, you know, even the taxi driver, the first one that I told him about, he said, of course, it's clear, but in science, at least in the group that we studied, and actually in many fields up to date, in textbooks, perception is considered to be passive. Like you open a textbook, you ask, okay, what is perception? They say, okay, in vision, it begins when something hits the retina. It ends when something pops up somewhere in the brain. And that's it. It's an open-ended system in current textbooks. And when we got to the sensory organ, we realized that this is active, and the active sensing actually changed the whole game. The coding, neural coding at the periphery, at the sensory organ, is totally different if you apply passive stimulations or you let the system actively select the stimulations.
Yeah. So this is if the experimenter is manipulating the whisker in your case versus if the rodent, rat, I suppose in your case, is actually sort of investigating things and poking its nose around while it's whisking.
Actually moving the whiskers, or if you move the whiskers, you know, relying on Newton, you might think by the third law it should be the same, but the mechanics is not the same. It's totally not the same. And the coding is totally different. This is the key point there. And then once we understood the coding, we went back to the higher levels. And then we realized that everything is arranged in loops. You look at the anatomy, it's simply you open Book of Anatomy and you see that once the signals flow the sensory pathway, they immediately affect the motor pathway. You don't wait for the cortex to decide, you know, what's important and then feed the system. Of course, cortex is involved, but it sees a higher level of loop. You have a sequence of loops building stacked one above the other. Every one of them is operative. They are not shut down. You might think of them, it makes sense to think of them as evolve in the terms, the era of evolution going from the innermost to the outermost, and the cortex comes at the end, and many cortical loops, but they're all operating. So there's no open-ended process here at all.
They're all operating all the time, which is a very different, I don't know what textbooks say these days. I don't look at textbooks anymore, but in the old days though, right? It's very like, yeah, the light hits your retina and then it goes to the next station and gets processed there. And then it sends it to the next station and gets processed there. But what you're saying is there's this continuous dynamical loop, loops of loops, a structure of
it's
loops.
It's continuous and dynamic, and it should be fully explained and fully contained at every level of evolution. You know, animals that had fewer loops, it should still be operating, and evolution does not delete anything. It might inhibit it sometimes, but it's not delete. It just adds on top of. So all these things should operate dynamically, as you say, all the time. So this was the second insight. And then we could kind of explain to ourselves, at least, and colleagues, very well how the brain interacts with the world in this perceptual game through the whiskers, and also hypothesize it for vision, because there was a similarity between the two senses. But we had something missing, because we knew as humans that perception involves not only these continuous dynamic interactions with the world, but it also involves concepts and ideas. So when I tell you, look, there is a chair there, you change your interactions with the world because you already know there is a chair. And once you realize it's not a chair, it's a table, it also changes the dynamics. So the two things are interacting together. You have these brain world loops that are active, but you have the ideas and what that are operated, that are part of these dynamics. And then we enter to this field of, okay, let's see how these things are interacting. And this is what at the end brought us to this mind body thing. Here I came for call for help from my wife, Merav Achisar, who is also in the field, a brain scientist, more from the cognitive side, and she at the time developed with Charles Oxen the theory of reverse hierarchy, which says, look, many of the processes in the brain work in a reverse hierarchy manner. They start, they begin with the idea, and then if you want to perceive more about this chair that you talked about, then you go down, or the processes go down to lower and lower processes.
So this is like the Bayesian brain hypothesis and predictive processing accounts and active inference, for example.
Yeah, so this exists in both the brain world. So now when we combine the two approaches, we have this kind of two. So we took their reverse hierarchy hypothesis and converted it to a loop, top-down loop processes, and both of them should work in a predictive manner. Also, the motor sensory motor loops, whenever you have the loop closes back to the sensory organ, it's a predictive, it has this predictive nature, because the way that, let's say, if you go even to the sensory organ, the way that the whisker interacts with the world, it does it in a predictive manner. But what affects these predictions are these ideas that come from the top and says, look, this is a chair versus a table. And I jump to our visual system. It affects how you operate your sensory organ in a predictive manner. And the whole idea we plotted, and now this is more speculative, the next step that I'll describe, is that we talk about kind of a handshake. This is how to, okay, transmit to the audio listeners, but kind of a handshake of the two hierarchies. So you have, if the fingertip is the top of a hierarchy and the root of the hand is the bottom of the hierarchy, then you have the top-down hierarchy talking, handshaking with the bottom-up hierarchy. And what is top in one hierarchy talks in details with the bottom of the other hierarchy, basically. So the two are interlaced together in a manner that you have at every brain station. Here you have a conversation, you might say, of the bottom up, which are these motors, sensory motor loops that I described before, the brain world loops, and the top down information that comes from the top. The best candidate for these are the efferent scopy loops, the efferent scopy pathways that, you know, everything that comes from the top sends efference to every stations in the.
So yeah, the efference station is just a copy of the signal being sent elsewhere.
Exactly. And this, if you plot the whole thing, then you get a complementary picture of loop that goes, that it's surrounding the idea. So you have one set of loops surrounding the sensory organ at the bottom. These are the loops that I described before, going through the brainstem, thalamus, cortical levels. And another one who originates at the top and sends the loops that talks with these loops, but in a reverse manner. It's easy to plot. It's hard to talk to this.
So these are two sort of opposing interlacing loops. And part of the trick here is reversing the idea of what we commonly think of as hierarchy is the first loop, the sensorimotor loop, right? That's what we kind of normally think of as hierarchical, right? So the top of that hierarchy would be the cortex, for example.
Exactly.
Middle parts would be thalamus and brainstem, things like that. Yes. But then the other loop comes top down, and the top of that loop is in the sensorimotor, like those lower brain areas, right?
Exactly.
All right. And the bottom of that loop then would be where? Cortex, for example?
Yeah, some cortical points. And then here we are more vague, okay? And it should be something that relates to language and verbal communication. And this is where we added our third partner to this paper, Daniel Polanyi, because we said, look, okay, this top, you can start from the top by two major ways. One is that you have this sensory experience, and very fast you activate some concept at the top, let's say this chair, and then it starts to work backward. But you could get it from conversation with another person, and this is what we call the BB channel, the brain-brain channel. And here I can tell you a chair. I tell you, look, there is a chair there, and you already orient your loops. And once we realized that, we said, okay, we have here an information communication issue, and we asked Daniel to join, and this is the rest is kind of the story of the three of us. In information, the thing is that what we have, and here comes the duality, here actually starts the dualism that we propose, because we say the following thing. We say we have this brain machinery that interlaces these two set of loops, one with the other, and this is the core of the perceptual system. It occurs with this interaction. Now the origin of the signals of the brain world system are the senses, the information coming from the senses. The origin of the signals coming to the brain-brain centers are these verbal communication from other people. Now we move to talk on mostly about humans. We can take it to animals later, but now we talk about humans because in humans, this digital domain is very rich.
Well, you just used the word digital, which is, so there's a digital analog.
So now duality. We say, okay, now we look at him and then we say, look, there's a very clear difference in the nature of the signals. The signals that are running and are interacting in the brain world's domain are analog, continuous, and you cannot put borders between them. The signals that run between brains are digital. These are words, phonemes. Every phoneme or word has a meaning, has a digital meaning, separate, distinct meaning, and they are also distinct in time. So these are digital
communication. Distinct and discrete, and they're categorized.
Right, and categorized, exactly. And the categorization is what eventually links back these two domains. So the BB domain talks about the BW domain in a categorized manner. I'm saying chair. I don't give you, this is a category of things. I'm saying table. This is a category of things. And this is the only thing that we communicate between us. We don't communicate the analog signal. The reason is probably very simple. It's in reliability of information transfer. The example I usually give is the following. Let's say I give you this example and ask you to repeat it, or even myself to repeat the distance between my fingers. I will not be able to do it. We both will not be able to say if I repeat the same thing or not. But if I tell you, look, I showed you three decimeters, this you can remember for life, you know, these three, and because it's digital, and we assume, and in the digital game, we assume, we have a convention between us that I never transmit to you things between these digits. So in the case of digit, I'm saying it's either three or four or two. I don't transmit to you half of things. This is a convention. I could, you know, show you a smaller finger, but we have a convention of the receiver and the sender. And based on this convention, we build our digital communication. The signals actually that we transmit are analog. This is an analog signal. The convention is the digital.
So somehow that convention comes about. So we can only communicate digitally. Well, the signals that we use to communicate are analog, and they get processed in an analog fashion through our sensory motor loops. But the information, the meaning, is always digital. It's never a continuous distribution, because we have to do that if we want to agree on what we're communicating about, if we want exactly. A reliable signal.
Exactly. And then the question of emergence comes. It's an important question. We can touch on it or leave it, because I'm working on it, on how it evolves.
Let's get to emergence later. I mean, there are a couple things here to linger on. One of which is just, So we talked about those reverse order loops, right? So when I say chair to you, your ears receive it and they process it in this analog fashion. So how do, and yet what we need is the reverse order hierarchy, where the top of the bottom of the hierarchy is what we normally think of as the top of the hierarchy. Let's say the bottom is in the cortex or something. But the analog audio signal coming into and getting processed by your cochlea still has to get processed in a sensory manner. So how does the digital aspect of chair then begin from the bottom of the hierarchy in the cortex or something? Does that make sense?
So let me see if I understood you. We have this interaction of the two processes, the top down and the bottom up. And the question I think that you ask is how this digital idea gets translated to an analog prediction. Is that
what I really want to know is so your idea is that there is like the digital processing happening in the brain still. It's just from in a different hierarchical order, right? So I send you a digital signal. My wish is to send you the number 2. So I say 2, and your ears have to process that. And your ears aren't processing it from digital; they're processing it from analog. So how is it magically
phone
digital?
Board. Okay, of a phone board. So here we come at the end of this discussion. We'll come to the strange loop of Hopstetter.
Something
that reminds this. So it goes as follows. So first, I would say that in the brain, everything is analog because the brain is a physical element, physical tissue. It's analog.
Digital. Everything in the world is analog.
Everything
right?
in the world is analog. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, in the world, except our conventions, which is you might say they're also in the world, but our conventions. This is the other domain. This is the spiritual domain.
This is the dualistic nature of your account. Yeah.
Sorry?
So this is the dualistic nature of your account, you can have a different domain.
Yeah. Exactly. We have a different domain. The different domain is a social kind, as the philosophers like to say. Social kind, and its root is in our convention. So we can ask how conventions came about, and this is a great question. It is actually, we can call it a hard problem by itself. This is a question, but we admit that they are there. Conventions are there between us. This is how we speak. This is how I understand each other, by conventions. By the way, electrical circuits understand each other. One transistor understands the other by convention, by our conventions. I don't know what the electrons, the transistors heard, but we induce conventions that it has to be either 1 or 0 in order for them to transmit whatever we do with that. So computers
even though their analog
realize,
value is fluctuating within
it's not actually
a certain
fluctuation,
region.
Right? But we categorize it and assume, and computers implement our digital regime much better than us. This is why they can control one day our BB domain better than us. This is a danger. But back to the processing. So we said the brain is so. Everything that happens in the brain is analog and physical. And now the question is how the digital meets this domain. So I'll say the tipping point of the conversion. Okay, the whole thing of the brain is to merge the two. This is what you ask is actually a huge task of the brain, a major task of the brain. And something like the tipping point of this process are the attractors that we suspect. I think it's agreed upon that, you know, cortical networks show attractor-like behavior, which is in all the complexity of these dynamical processes, you have some dwelling points of the dynamical system. The dwelling points are dynamics, dynamical state that the system prefers to be for a while. Let's say in the case of the cortex, usually it's 200, 300 milliseconds. The system relaxes to some state, let's say consistent firing. You know, the examples of the Jennifer Halmiston cells or this like of cells that you see something like 200, 300 milliseconds in which the cell is kind of stationary. The statistic is stationary and then it takes off, something like this. And if you extend this, then you can imagine that these kind of hook-like attractors exist in this network, which is attractors is simply a state, dynamical state, stochastic state that the system prefers to be for a while there. And this is the tipping point between the digital and the analog game. Why? The labeling of these attractors is a near digital. Once we both say Jennifer, let's say, the assumption is that a set of attractors in my brain talks to a set of attractors to your brain. They are both near the digital analog, but they are coordinated. And we educated each other, or better to say, we educate our kids to say this is green, this is the attractor for green. We never know what is the attractor in their brain, but we say, look, whatever you experience now, this is green and this is blue. This is green and this is blue. Repeat it and they label. We label their attractors with names. And this labeling is the digital thing. This is the conventional domain. The rest is, so once you tell me green, or chair, you tell me chair and it hits the attractors in my brain that are homolog to your attractor when you say a chair. They activate them and there starts the top-down reverse hierarchy.
Game to get to that state, you have to process. What my point was, you still have to process it through the ear, right? Through your sense organs.
So the process goes down to the ear. So the, again?
No, but when you say chair, before you say chair, I'm not thinking chair. I have no top down, bottom up, whatever. You say chair, it has to hit my sense organ.
Okay, if it comes as a full surprise, then it might take you, you know, to say to me, say again. If it was a full surprise, if I say something like you say now, you would say, so I said chair in Hebrew and you got the signal, but you didn't categorize it as anything. But if you expect, if you are in the midst of conversation, you already know me, you got used to my tone of voice, etc., your loops are always working. And they kind of expect, as we now learn from the LLMs, you know, they expect what will be my next word in high probability. You can expect, you can prepare your system. And part of the preparation are these loops or part of the loops that come to the outer hairs in the inner ear. These are the, you know, the most peripheral way in which the brain affects what you hear. And model on actually also the, you know, the small bones in the middle ear, in other animals, it's also the, so you tune your, system to whatever you expect, you're going to hear. Part of it will be the pitch of my speech. Part of it will be the kind of word or spectral, you know, domain that you hear. But the ear is not enough. I mean, this is the starting point. And then you have at every level, you have something of predictive tuning of what you expect to see. And in a manner of comparison, you see if you are right or not in here Bayesian processing problem.
So when I first meet you, right, and I have no idea that you absolutely love to talk about chairs, we start talking. Are you saying that it's hard to say top and bottom here of the loop. Are you saying the digital beginning of the loop needs to be, how would I want that to look? Because it's in a predictive state based on, right, you're wearing glasses. So I think, oh yeah, like you don't have perfect vision. I can kind of tell your age. When you start to speak, I get a sense of your voice and your accent and where you might be from. So I start forming these expectations, but I have no idea you love to talk about chairs. Like, do I need to be in a state of readiness of complete non-attractor states, right? And then as soon as you say chair, I form an attractor. This is a little detailed. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to think through the...
It's a good question, and I don't have a full or good answer for that. But I think it hits to the point of conceptions. You know, we have, in Israel at least, we have a big... connotations to the term of conception, because we have wrong conceptions from now and then. But I keep telling to my friends, look, we live by conceptions. We live, when we go out to the street with the car, we live by conception that everybody drives on the right side. So we have the conception of what we are going to hear. If something comes as a full surprise, I believe maybe you'll not even notice it. Or maybe you'll hear some noise and you say, okay, I have no idea. So you always build some conception and you come ready for something that you're going to perceive. This is part of this active perception thing, that you must be prepared all the time to what you're going to perceive. And this doesn't stop. You know, maybe when we go to sleep, probably at this time, you know, between you, when you just before you fall asleep and just when you wake up and you are totally confused, maybe this is the point without conceptions. But all the other things you already said, I'm going to see this, I'm going to my room, I'm going to see this and that and that, and they don't see You know, it takes you time to see changes. You expect to see things. You're sure every magician knows it. You know, you're sure you see it, but you don't see it, basically.
Right. Yeah, that's the magic. That's the magician's trick. Okay. So I got us a little bit off track there. And then as you're talking about conception, I'm thinking about Gibson's affordances and where those sit in the digital analog, right? So when I see a doorway, I can only see the doorway as a doorway because I've digitized it as a symbol, essentially, of the idea of the door, but somehow I know I can pass through the door, which is the affordance. So I don't know if you want to go down that road, but...
Yeah, affordances sits very nicely. All ecological perception sits very nicely with this scheme of active sensing and the brain world loops. But then we have all the loops. So digital. So you see an opening. Let's say the example is that you can grab something, right? So you see some weird, and you can grab. You plan your movement. You don't have it to be digital in order to do it. It can be solved by the lower loops already. So you tune and you tune it as you move, right? You have this feedback and you tune it and it's there. Part of it is digital. So part of it, if you want to tell me, look, this passage is too narrow, then it must go through the digital domain.
It's either too narrow or not too narrow.
Or not, yeah, right. You must convey the information to some other person, then you must go to the digital domain. But when you do it yourself, you don't have to. You probably may think about it. You may think about it later. It becomes digital. You can categorize it later. But while operating in the world, you can, the lower loops can do it. So we said everything, like I said, the tipping point maybe are the attractors, levers. And this is also the place where I think when now we talk about consciousness, again, I borrow terms that I learned. So there is the notion of Matt Block about access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness that people debate and
take it. Can you just describe what those are?
So in the literature of consciousness, let's open one bracket here. Double or dual discussion there in my eyes. Okay, when I come as a kind of visitor to this world, most of the studies on consciousness are actually on perceptual consciousness. And the question is, are you conscious to what you saw or not? Basically, this is, but when laymen people think about consciousness, they also think about self-consciousness, to know who is the perceiver, who am I, what makes me, etc. And what is the subjective experience in this game? So one attempts to make order in this, and again, I may do injustice to deeper theories of consciousness, but in my view, is a kind of a layperson view in this field. So one attempt to make an order is this distinction between access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. To say, look, there are things that I can talk about them. I can tell you about them. I can access them in myself. So if you ask me, why did you go this opening? I'll tell you, look, I figured out that this is wide enough and I went there. But there are things that I cannot tell you because if you ask me, okay, how it is to see green. What is it like for you to see green? You cannot tell me about this. And this is subjective. This is phenomenal consciousness. You know, you talk about something that happens to you. This is subjective experience, but you cannot describe it to me. And in my view, this is the phenomenal consciousness. So the dividing point in this scheme, in our scheme, the BWBB scheme, is this attractor level. So up to everything that is labeled, these attractors that I labeled, I can tell you about. If you tell me, okay, why you call it green, and I tell you, look, it's closer to the green than the blue, and I can talk about the label things, this is okay, I can access that. Everything that is below there to tell you what are the processes that govern my brain when I looked at this green versus the other green, this is subjective experience that is not accessible for me. The reason, so we are not the only one who's saying it, but it came clear to us from this work that one of the reasons that you cannot access them by this explanation of attractors is that an attractor, you can get to the same label from almost infinite trajectories, starting point and trajectories. So if you think about all the physical events that happen in the in this brain world loops, which at the end end up in one attractor of green, there are infinite number of them, and you cannot go back. Once you know the label, there's no information that tells you how to go back to what led to this label. So this is lost. You have it. It's physical in your all subjective experience in our scheme is physical because it happened in your brain. Everything, the attractors and the expression and what led to them is subjective experience. But I can talk to you about the relationship between my attractors. I cannot talk to you about what led to these attractors because these are not labeled processes.
Is it entropy also?
Sorry, what?
I suppose. Because of entropy, because there are an infinite number of directions, you can't put the shattered glass back together of your
exactly.
trajectories.
Yeah, it's the same.
Okay. So we were talking about, so you were making the distinction between access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. And that, so you're mapping access consciousness onto the attractor states that we can then share between each other.
Yes.
So then remind me where, it's not a great question. Where then is subjective experience in general, like within this account?
So subjective experience.
To say where is it is a terrible question.
Yeah, I know.
So, sorry.
I agree with you. Where is not, what is, yeah, but we have to use words in science.
I know we have to.
We are locked in words. These
what,
are categories.
What is subjective experience like for you, Ehud? Yeah.
So subjective experience to me is everything that happens in my brain, in my body, actually. I'm embodied a scientist. Everything that, because, I mean, the brain is not a brain in the dish. The brain is connected to the body, especially in perception, we see. So when I say in the brain, I mean the brain and all its connections to the body. So subjective experience that everything that happens to me, part of it I can report to you, and this is the access consciousness. Really.
If I'm sitting in a state of meditation, mindfulness meditation, where I'm, so the goal is to maybe focus on something, but just notice when quote unquote ideas kind of float in and just watch them float out, right? And I'm not trying to cogitate. I'm not trying to think and move ideas around. I'm just in a state of noticing. Would that map on? So in a sense, the goal is to kind of be as close as possible to this phenomenal consciousness, this sense of subjective being. So would that be brain world? I'm really trying to locate the subject here in your account.
Yeah. I get it. So in meditation, which I tried not too many times, but I did try, I think we are in the BB domain because we try to shut off all the sensations. So we sit quiet and we try to ignore these pains, et cetera, and to remove them and also ignore the thoughts. We sit, once we are thinking, we are in the BB domain. Even if we are alone and forget about other people, but we are there. We are social kind. We use the items that are used in society, but we use them ourselves when we think in the world. And now we try to avoid, so the meditation is a clever game of try to avoid, to play within this field, the BB, but now to play, to be an observer that is not affected by some of the thoughts, something like this. So you divide yourself. This is a kind of, to me, it looks like a training, like any other training to use kind of hierarchical thinking within your BB domain. So you divide yourself to an independent or indifferent observer and all the rest, and you train on it, and you manage to do it.
So you're categorizing yourself in a way.
Again, what?
you're categorizing yourself. You're drawing a line saying,
yes, also, yes, right, right. And yeah, right. And this, in this BB world, I think it's a huge field of hierarchies of categorization and context dependent categorization that has to be studied. I mean, there are studies like in working memory, et cetera, that begin to touch there, but these are all, so when I say BB domain, it sounds like one thing, but this is a rich, a huge domain.
I'm not going to go down through all my questions here, but there's the question of language. So first of all, you were working on rodents, and then you kind of slipped in, and then we started thinking about humans and the
digital...
I'm also
working on humans. So I'm working on vision in humans, in virtual reality. So where I can control, you know, the world and monitor the eye movements. Maybe this is one more thing to mention, that in all this vision of active sensing and brain world loops, there is a bottleneck that is, to me, it's the best best place to monitor experimentally. So when I worked with rodents and previously with monkeys, I used to penetrate the brain and look for signals, etc. But as you know, this is a mess, and it's a continuum, and you don't know where to put the balls, etc. And it's high dimensional. But there is one, if you believe in the brain world loops, there is a one point which is the lowest dimensional in the game, and this is the sensory organ itself. Because it has, you know, several degrees of freedom to move and several variables, and that's it. The world is high dimensional, the brain is high dimensional, but the connection between them is a bottleneck, basically. And we use this bottleneck to track the dynamics of perception. So we say if it's true that the perception works in loops, there should be the same dynamics to the entire loop. And the best place to track is by following the sensory organ, either the whisker in the rat or the eye movement. So we use accurate eye tracking in virtual reality in order to track this brain world dynamics. This is what I mean.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you I'm going to ask you to speculate, I suppose, going away from like the sensory organs here into more, this is a question about the digital brain aspect, because in some sense, this is kind of what you can, the brain world is sort of where we live in neuroscience, and it's sort of common ground for us to talk about how signals get processed in brain areas. But then maybe the more difficult thing is to talk about the brain. And so there's this idea of that there's a convention between us that we decide my green is your green. We're going to digitize green, and we both have attractor green states. One question about that is in relation to humans, I guess, versus other non-linguistic animals. And this is maybe a chicken and an egg question. Did we form symbols? So I took this course in college about how language came about. And one of the suggestions, there's lots of, theories, is that it's the ability to form symbols that allowed humans to then exchange those symbols in the early days of accounting for how many goats you gave me so that I could keep track of that and give you some lamb next year or whatever. So do you think that is the digitization an ability that evolved and that gave rise to language? I know the answer is co-evolution here, but
must be evolution,
was language necessary for digitization, for that convention, or how do you view that?
No, I think language is an extreme case of digitization.
Right.
Actually, it's a question that I work on with a colleague now, with molecular biologists, expert in genetics, because the question do we have a co-evolution or one emerges from the other? This is kind of the hard problem that I mentioned before, because they say, okay, you have these conventions, but where did they come from?
Right. That's really what I want to ask you.
Yes, how does a convention emerge from an analog? You have an analog dynamic system. Where come a convention between two items there? And my intuitive bias is to say it has to be co-evolution. Otherwise, we have a very, you know, hard problem of creation here. How was this thing created at any point? And the co-evolution has some justification that, that to say that you have this, from the beginning that we can think of at least, you had always discrete and continuous events. So even if you talk about physics today, okay, there are these discrete events in quantum mechanics. People talk about even on quantized space. So you have discrete elements there, out there, at least in the way that we think about the world. And there are analog processes there, dynamical processes. And the question is, were they there from the beginning? I believe so. That, you know,
which ones? The analog ones, were they there for the
both discrete and continuous were there. And then the question, how the discrete evolved towards a digital, which a digital needs this convention and, but you had, if you had these discrete events in different places, then you can think about ways that they can, build together a digital code. For example, the genetic code is a digital code, right? You have a code for a specific amino acid. This is the code. And it has to emerge for something. And we believe that it emerged from discrete things that are there all the time. But, and down the evolution, so you can go through the genetic code and go to a language. Language is a very advanced way of digitization. And our computers that we, not me, but we humanity invented are even more extreme. And the AI today is even more extreme and is more talented, so to speak, than us in the BB domain, because it's just digital. It's not confused by the other things. Yeah, remember how, you know, difficult for us is to digitize things and say, 27 minus 13, well, I have to stop everything else and to do it. And for this, the chips is nothing. There's a danger there in AI. It's easy for the AI to get control on the BB domain because it is so better than us. But maybe something to be optimistic about is that it is only there. The AI today, computer-based AI, has nothing to do with the BW world. The robotics is no way, you know, near the level of advancement of the LLMs and the screen constraint AI devices.
No, but aside from, like, if I came and murdered you, that would be a brain world operation. But if I'm trying to manipulate you, I can do it through the brain way.
Yes,
and
yes,
we're very
yes.
manipulable, and we sort of worship brain talent, right? That's kind of what we think of as intelligence almost.
Yes. Intelligence is the BB, right? The way we, humanity, formalize, quantize, and appreciate intelligence is all BB and digital ways. Of course, people talk about, you know, social intelligence and this kind of other kind of mimicking artistic intelligence, etc., which are not the BB, but the IQ test is a BB test.
Yeah.
And yes, humanity, I'm not expert in this, but I think if you go through humanity, let's say in the last 2,000-3,000 years, the BB get stronger and stronger. So let's say each of us has both the integration of the BB and BW domains, but also the fight. So I think meditation, part of it is a fight back against society to say, look, BB, with all the respect, society gets too much of me, right, through the BB domain, and let me get apart. And I think this is a kind of a fight back because the BB domain becomes stronger and stronger. We see it with, the social groups in the digital domain and the AI, etc. It becomes stronger and stronger in our life, community life, compared to the BW. And people try to fight back. You know, people do this, try to to raise kids without screens, etc., etc. This is attempts, maybe hopeless. I don't know, but I think not hopeless because as everything, it's at some point it will balance, hopefully. But this is kind of a struggle between the power that the BB and the BW has in our lives, in our consciousness.
So we're all individuals, and we have this, you'd characterize it as like you would say it's an interaction, but you were talking about that interaction can become a struggle when the balance is shifted too far, I suppose, toward BB versus BW, and perhaps vice versa.
You mean the interaction can be what again? When the balance goes...
So the interaction could be characterized as a struggle when the balance is off, right? Like, yeah. Like in the brain, you have excitation-inhibition balance. Maybe you have BB versus BW balance in your interpersonal subjective state of well-being, right?
This is a good point. I think, yes, maybe like the EI balance. Yes, I like it. This is what I meant. With all these words, just the balance, that we have a balance and in a kind of homeostatic attempt, we try to keep this balance, but this goes across generation. It's not a rapid, it's a very slow process. So, you know, when someone raises kids, and try to avoid the screens, is a kind of this homeostatic, fight back or feedback.
Dude, we're fighting so hard. We fight so hard in this house to do that, but it's pointless.
Takes generations, probably. Yeah,
maybe so. How do I make my daughter less BB and more BW? Just kidding. I'm not going to come to you for therapeutic advice. You talk about how the digitization, the digital side of this, the symbolic side, allows the generation of symbols. If something is digital, it can be a symbol. Let's see if you agree with this. A symbol is a digital thing with meaning attached to it. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
So digitization then allows symbolic things to happen, which allows computation, which is one of the benefits of digitizing of ideas is it allows
you can compute. There's no analog. People talk about analog computers. I never understood what it is. You have analog processes. Computing is digital. This is my idea.
And so in our brains, we know we have spikes, which we can digitalize, but we know that they are analog processes. And I guess what I want to ask you is what you think of. Like when I use the phrase, I will find the computational mechanism of working memory, am I assuming that I relate that to like the pattern of spiking action potentials in populations of neurons or something. So sort of broadly, what's your take on computation terminology in reference to like brain processes, explaining brain processes?
Yeah, I think the term computational is abused for many years now for marketing purposes or something like this. It's a wrong concept. I mean, the brain, if you look at it, it's an analog tissue. It does not compute. The brain does not compute. We compute. Computers compute. We can use the brain to compute. The brain does not compute and cannot compute because it doesn't have digital states or value. People use it. Now it became kind of, I think the name, it is very attractive to students. We know it, right? You say, oh, computational brain science. Of course, it's much better than
hardcore
neurophysiology or something like this. Right. But it is misleading. I think it's misleading because of that. Because when you look at spikes, you want to study working memory. You look at the spikes and say, okay, where is the computation here? You'll not find it. You impose on it some computation, it will never be correct. This is my take on it. Yeah.
And yet it can correlate pretty well. But I think that you can squint and make a lot of different correlations. So you bring in the computation, you say it must be doing that computation. I will fit it to that computation. Yeah, whatever it's doing, I can fit it to the computation.
Yeah, we always do it. Okay, I have to admit, I also force my models on the tissue that I study, but then the test is by peer reviewing or by peer judgment of people and the students. I mean, actually the commitment of students should be to listen to the lecturers or to look at the textbooks and what people tell them and to ask, is it a computation? Tell me why, in the case of computation, why this is a computation? In order not to confuse ourselves, because the term computation, as I said, confuses how we approach the system. And if I impose the model of a computation, in my view, you'll never find the solution because the process is not the computation. So we have to be careful here, and we have to encourage the students to ask the questions in this regard.
I mean, I 100% agree with you, and I'm going down a little bit further on this road with you than I should, mainly because I'm in an active project, examining the use of the term computation, for example, and what it really means in neurosciences.
But
on the one hand, and in discussions, with people and my partner on this project, we find ourselves we have to look at the literature and see what people are actually meaning when they say computation, because in some sense it's like a filler term and it just means how it works. It doesn't mean computation. It means the way that it is, the way the representations change over time is computation.
Yeah,
the trajectories in dynamical space is computation.
Yeah. They confuse quantification, a quantity study with a computational study. I think this is.
But are you okay with using the term, are you okay with the term computation having changed meaning and now we don't actually mean a Turing style algorithmic computation? We just mean it's computing it because it hit this attractor state and then it went to the other attractor state and that's a computation. Are you okay with that?
No. I think it's a bad term because we know what computation is. We cannot change indeed the meaning of it. And we know we know that the brain does not, at least we, both of us know, but many people know that the brain does not compute. And once we try to impose the term computation, even if we use the right terms, we know that one spike computes the meaning of the other spike. We confuse ourselves and the students. And I don't think we should, I think we should avoid using it. I don't see how we can recruit the term because we lose resolution. We use the same term to describe different things. Why should we do it? This is the wrong thing to do. If we focus on things, let's find the right words for these things.
So, all right. Thank you. I appreciate that, and I'm cheering inside. So is AI computing? Let's talk AI about computes. AI and that analog digital duality, right?
Yeah, AI does compute, and people forget that you take the perceiver. Forget about LLMs right now, but let's talk about perceiving AIs. Okay, those that identify dogs and or the deep networks, and people forget that the whole process is digital from the beginning to the end. Why is it digital? Because the frame-based capture of the image is already digital. You digitize it to these pixels and the frame rate, and it's digital input to this machine. In the brain, it's not like this. In the brain, we have this active sensing, let's say in vision. So you move. When you move, you have this event-based coding in the retina, right? The cells in the retina respond only to changes. And every cell responds asynchronously to the change that it confronts. And the change that it sees depends on the interaction of the movement, direction, and speed, and what is out there. So the coding is totally different than the frame-based coding. The eye is not a camera. And this is a big debate, and many people envision, and I'm being surprised by this, that people work on cortical processes and they don't ask themselves what is the actual input from the retina, because it changed a lot. If the input is temporally based, all the processing should be different. So AI takes it, starts from the digital representation and goes on. And in digital case, you can use the term representation. It's okay. This is what digital does. It represents one or another. There's no representation in this sense in the analog world. So this is what we have to keep in mind, that AI, all AI today is digital. For the LLMs, it's a more, let's say, how to say, it's more correct to do it because, as we say, LLM lives in the BB domain. BB is digital. For the LLMs to start digital and digitally, it's okay. But for the perceiver, the perceptual deep networks, something is missing there. It's okay. I mean, they do a wonderful job. With a lot of energy, but wonderful job, but it's not enough brain-like. Somewhat brain-like in this, connectivity scheme and learning algorithm, stochastic learning, but it's not fully brain-like, and this active sensing and analog input level are still missing there.
Is it a sort of sub-goal, or you just believe that AI could be improved by incorporating Brain World?
I think it can be improved. Definitely in power. Should be more power-saving, sustainable.
What does improvement mean? Because you earlier you said, well, maybe it's a good thing that AI is solely BB.
Yeah, okay, exactly. This was my next reservation, that improvement for the AI, it will be better. Is it better for us?
Oh, okay.
So yeah. This is a correct question. Maybe we have to keep some regime for us to say, okay, you AI, you still there. You can rule this kingdom. We have to be careful there also. But this is us. This is ours. Don't invade our regime. But if from the AI perspective, if it wants to be better, or could.
And so you, and to do that, you think you would need like a timing code, like an event-based input?
Yeah, it should be event-based temporal code. Yeah, this should be.
And LLMs based. Are halfway there?
No, LLMs are not halfway there. LLMs do not need it, basically because they live in the digital domain. I mean, they digital. They talk about what they do is digital from the beginning to the end, so they don't need it, basically.
So do we have to have...
See, they could be better in power. They could be more sustainable if they move to a spike-based, event-based mode altogether. This will be much more power-saving.
But would that improve their capability? Let's say we don't care about power. Let's say we have an infinite energy source.
Yeah. So about LLMs, I'm not sure. For the receivers, I'm confident that, yes, it would improve them. But for LLMs, I don't know. I have to study more.
So in your dualistic account, can you have a subjective experience if you only have BB? Or if you only have BB, you're not even in the physical world. You're in the spirit world, right?
Yes, you could be in simulation. You could be whatever people... Yes, you're totally spiritual. And I think, you know, you talk about a sidekick on this, that all the spiritual world that we talk about, that, you know, the literature and religion and all these spiritual domains live within the BB. They are all domains of words. They live within the BB domain very nicely. Actually, you can map many, many spiritual processes to this BB domain, the digital domain. Naturally tailored for it. This is there.
Sort of like platonic forms floating in
platonic,
the...
Platonic, exactly. Platonic shapes and forms live there. And these are the concepts that even in platonic description, he talks about it. Okay, I have this BB concept. Now let's see how reality fits this concept. This is exactly the BB and BW interaction. Exactly.
So where did this come from?
where these two?
Like, what? I mean, do you have a sense of? I mean, again, like the brain world, right? The sensory motor domain. That's sort of like our natural place of being able to investigate. But somehow, the brain, the realm of ideas. It's not in the real world in the terms. It's not physical, right? So
the physical. We have it's to the just... real world because we use it. So we are in the we are real, I believe, and our spirits or souls or minds are there, are social kind, as philosophers say. We are part of society. I mean, we should look at it in the terms of evolution and co-evolution. And in terms of evolution, we individuals cannot be, I know that I have argument, surprisingly argument with this, with experts of evolution. And I'm saying, look, we cannot be the subject of natural selection because we do not survive. We individuals. It's either our genes, like the selfish genes, or the society, the community. The community survives, the genes survive, but we individuals do not. Anyway, surprisingly, some people argue against it, but I believe that society, I more believe in the society as being the major. And in society, we are like ants in a community. We are, you know, peons of the society. And society gets its sharing and its power, not because we do make a favor to each other. We say, okay, let's cooperate. We have free choice together. We could cooperate or not. And we make, you know, a decision, okay, let's cooperate. Probably not. The way that I understand evolution, probably not. If society survives, it means that every it has a proxy in every each of us, let's say the frontal lobe, roughly, sure. The executive system. Yeah, what else? Is a proxy of society. We don't do things that society does not allow us because of this proxy. It does not allow us. It sits here and controls us. So all this BB domain is there for the survival of the society. We are kind of peons in this game. So if you look at this in this manner, and then we combine it combined to it convolution to see how it comes from these descriptive and cognitive things. Maybe we will not answer, you know, the big question of how it all started, etc. Is it meat? We can talk about the coevolution, yes.
But we kind of have to accept it's there because it's you observe there is an exchange of ideas, and that exchange has to happen. So we can posit, we can assume.
Yes,
that there is, because we see it taking place. So yeah,
it's here. It's here, right? We know it's here. It's not physical, but it's here. This is why I became a dualist. I surprised myself, you know, that a few years ago they say, "Look, you are a dualist." By the way, comparing to Descartes that we talked about, now I read again or thought about his meditation of the book of the great move that he did from throwing everything that he the meditations. What's the name of the book? That he threw away everything that he doubted about and remained with one thing, his thought. So basically, Descartes was a monist. The great dualist ended up as a monist, spiritual monist in this
movie. Yeah, but wasn't that a digital thing to do, right? I still have a thought. He categorized it as a thought.
Yeah. But this is what he told himself and to the readers. Look, I removed everything that I don't trust. I remembered one thing, my thought. My thought exists. That's it. And when I do now the same trip back, I feel that I end up with two things. I have my thought. I have my subjective experience. It's not only my thought. I have the subjective experience. I sit here. I talk to you. I have these things. I cannot get rid of them. I cannot remain only with my thoughts. Although in meditation, we try, we cannot. We have the body.
So all thoughts to you are digital, but experience is analog?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
All experience is analog and all thoughts are digital. They are not in the body. They are actually not in the body. This is the spiritual part of them. They are in our interbrain space, domain.
Well, if I'm sitting in a room, even if, so you and I are not communicating, but I'm thinking about you sitting on chairs and stuff. So I'm sort of talking to myself. Would that be your account of it? Is that's still brain, but now it's my brain to my brain?
Yes.
Because I can manipulate these symbols. Yeah.
Yeah. Brain. It's use your capacity as if you talk to someone, but it happens to be yourself. But this is it.
So what's the hard problem now? Because I want to know like how brain and how brain world interact within my own self, because I want to know how thinking works and how experience works and how cognition works, right? So I began in the very beginning saying like your work kind of reorients the focus of where to look for a solution, doesn't necessarily solve it. So let's maybe return to that and discuss your work in relation to the Chalmers hard problem of consciousness and how your work reframes that.
Yeah, so my imagined dialogue with Chalmers, I'll be happy to make it physical, is the following. We resolved or suggested a solution to the meta problem of Chalmers. The meta problem is, why do we have the hard problem to begin with? Why do we ask ourselves this question? And this is the distinction that I told you between the access and phenomena, so to speak, or between the things that the reason that we cannot get back to our analog, from the digital domain, trace back the analog processes, the subjective experience. This is the reason that we come up with this question. We know, we talk about things. We can talk about things out there. We cannot talk about things in there, in our brain. And this raises a problem. Why can't we talk about them? And this is what we explain by this ability of going back from an attractor label to its resources. So we address the meta problem. Now, the hard problem, as I said, disappears once you are a dualist. Chalmers itself does not have a hard problem. He poses it to the materialist, but he says, I'll solve it. I'm a dualist, so I'm okay. The hard problem in our solution moves from this question of explanation, the subjective experience, to the explanation of how the digital convention emerged. This is a hard problem. And here I'm again a dualist kind of, because I believe in coevolution. So this is a dualistic solution.
It's like a proposition of how to go about finding a solution. It's not a solution. I guess dualism...
I mean, the hard problem is not a problem to the dualist. Yeah, because the dualist, the materialist, the monist has to explain how one emerges from the other, and he cannot.
Mm-hmm.
No, they exist from the beginning, I don't have a problem. They exist. I have to show you how they evolve, but not the existence problem.
And a property dualist has to account for how the different properties arise from one.
Yeah, yeah. When we were trying to map our perceptual dualism, then we take it on the axis from the subject to the object, let's say, Cartesian dualism is in the substance, in the object itself. He says there are two different substances. The property dualism take it a little bit back to the subject because they say, okay, we see different properties in this object. The predicate dualism take it even closer and says, okay, we only talk differently about these things. And we say, no, we perceive differently. And we have no other choice. This is our insight. That we have no other choice because the way we build, because of this interaction of BBBW, we cannot see the world unless we see it dualistic in the digital and analog domain. And what we try mostly in science, but also in personal, but mostly in science is to take the digital domain closer and closer to the physical. Mm-hmm. So we use more terms and more resolution and more bits, etc., to get it closer and closer and closer to describe the BW better and better and better.
Oh, so there's like a limiting case. So we'll never
be there.
Never
you
be
can
there.
Add points to the, you know, that's a digit after the decimal point. But whenever you stop, like with even with differential calculus, whenever you stop your approximation, you remain in a digital domain. Although the gap will be small, but you never.
That's the whole point. Yeah, the whole point is to describe it in the digital domain and take the limit of the digital domain and call it analog.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You call it out.
So when you're driving in your car and you have an epiphany on...
Yeah, what? Again?
Let's say you're driving in your car. I'm going back to your earlier story. You're driving in your car you have an epiphany, right?
Epiphany,
it's like a creative thought, right? Solution. You come up with a solution.
Yeah.
How do my digital and analog processes, loops, interact? Like, is that... Do I come up with a solution fully in the symbolic, computational, digital realm? Or is there some interaction with the analog? Okay. How does that work?
That's a good, good question, a good metaphor. I would say if I try to imagine. So I used all my BB knowledge from engineering, what I learned from neuroscience, etc. These are all terms, like the phase-lock loop, the oscillators and the phase-lock loop and the... Time also is a BB item. And try to match them by action. So what happens to me in the car, indeed, I remember until today, probably it was strong, because I remember my palpation. So I was doing it, perceiving it, and try to describe it at the same time with words.
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of an attempt to close the two. Yes, it's a good example. Okay, thanks for reminding me. It was a great, you know, I also remember why I drove, where I drove and why. It was so strong, the feeling there.
Yeah.
I remember the whole thing. But indeed, this interaction, it was kind of, and this is kind of a moment of insight, I think, in this terminology, is when you either create a new attractor or merge several attractors to one. And this explained to me, I never, you know, I listened to things of Heidegger. And one of the things he said, look, the first mission or the most important mission of humans is to give names. And at the time I said, how stupid could it be? What does it mean to give names? It's nothing. But now I realize it's to create new attractors. Let's say, so this is the mission of science in this manner is to give names in his language to say, okay, now I have a new attractor. Let's say, let's find a new word instead of the computational to describe what happens in the cortical neurons. Now we find a new attractor that describes something closer to reality. We have a better description.
That's the goal. That's the goal is to describe. Yeah. But once you give a name to something, it's really hard to bring it back out of
yeah,
that digital domain, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, look at computational example. Once it's digging, it's very hard to take it out. So you have to go bypass it or invent a new path, a new world, a new name.
I know that you're not a philosopher, and I have a maybe more than passing interest in philosophy, and I'm not super knowledgeable about Heidegger, but it's interesting that you say that he mentions that the most important thing humans do is name things, and that's like categorize things, digitize things.
Yes.
In other words, in your language, digitize things.
This is what we do for a living.
So how does this jibe with, so when I think of Heidegger, I think of like his ideas about coping. Like he's all about how we're actually interacting with the world and our normal like skills. Like, Hilary Putnam would always, I think, use the example of like taking a hammer and its usefulness as a hammer, right? And coping in the world. And this is, it seems at odds with the most important thing is to name things. I'm not sure if you have thoughts on that with Heidegger. No,
this is another aspect of Heidegger and other philosophers of this term, like also I think Buber and Ade Gordon that I mentioned and others, that it was part of the fight back against the control of society. You can see it very clearly in this early 20th century. Society took over with all the industrial revolution, etc., took over very strongly on people. And this was an attempt to fight back, to say, look, nature talks to us, and Gibson's ecological perception was kind of a fight back against the dominance of the BB domain. This is how I see it today. So they got, attacked by the BB domain. Everybody told them, look, this is the computation, so to speak, or these are the terminology, etc. This is what happens in the brain. They say, no. The world is physical. We interact with it, and they try to show us how they interact. And to me, it looks like a fight back against it, and probably they lost because the trend continues, but maybe we can try to take it back.
Yeah, right. Yes, let's take it back. But I mean, on the other hand, it is the most beautiful thing. I mean, science wouldn't work without brain, without the digitization.
Science is a brain. Science is a brain.
Full-on brain.
Yeah, full-on brain, yes. We talk, talk from the brain.
Yeah, I mean, everything useful that we consider being useful is brain. And everything brain world is sort
social,
of the coping.
Social-wise. But for ourselves, I mean, this is the feeling that we have. Okay, we say, okay, we function beautifully as a society and we have advanced things, etc. We function. And also it's convenient to our life, etc. But we miss something. I mean, this is the feeling I see many people share. We miss something for ourselves. And this is why we go to nature and we go to meditation and these things. And we need the balance. As you said, this is a beautiful point. The BBW balance is an over-generation kind of homeostatic process, maybe.
Mm. Maybe. Yeah. I think personally, maybe this maps onto sort of a personal, not personal struggle, but the way that I think, right? Because part of the problem for me with language is as soon as I say a word, whoop, it's concrete now, it's digital, it's symbolic, and it's static, and it doesn't change. And so everything that I was thinking has come out in this particular word, and now I can't take it back, and I can't think anymore informing the word. And so in some sense, I've lost some of the high-dimensional brain world processing, right? And so I want to say that when I'm sitting there and I'm kind of thinking about things or letting my mind process things, that seems like brain world to me. That seems like this undergirding processing happening. And then as soon as it comes along and, oh, there's a word for that, I can't do anything. I can't do any more thinking about it.
Yeah, there are groups, and I'm very good friends in a place called Notz Madar, a place that they call themselves a school for one to learn himself. And other groups deal a lot with talking about the tree without the word tree. For example, this is kind of the slogan. Perceive the tree without the word tree, without the term tree. And you find yourself very, as you just described now, it takes very soon that the word come in, and they practice, and you can practice it. If you practice it, people report wonderful things in perception. So my friend reports, when he practices it, during the practicing, he felt something that he never felt before. I don't remember now exactly what was it, but he remembers it until now. you change the mode that you perceive because you give more weight to the BW. You get rid, shut off the BB for why. But it's very hard, as you say. You can do it for a while, and probably we can practice on doing it.
I remember trying to explain to my dad what acid felt like when I was younger. So I, you know, experimented with psychoactive drugs, right? Like LSD and stuff and mushrooms. And I remember this very well. We were in the car and he had never done anything like that. And he asked me to try to explain it to him. And the words that came out it's like embarrassing because I said, okay, do you see that fence post over there as we're driving by? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, when you're in that state, it's not a fence post. It's its own sort of thing, and it doesn't have a name, and you sort of take it as its own thing and not as a fence post. And so this is kind of the it of Buber and what you were just describing. So maybe when we take mushrooms and things like that.
Psychedelics. I did ayahuasca several times, and I had a similar feeling.
Really?
So psychedelics, and now it's very popular in attempts to treat PTSDs and other things. The psychedelics, the possibility is that they dissolve this attractor because
the attractors.
Yeah. On these serotonergic receptors, and there are some stronger ones work on the, like the Iboga. It works on several others, neurotransmitters. The idea is probably that they dissolve this strong attractiveness of the attractor, and then you get free to the interzone between them.
Including an ego sense of self, right? You could dissolve
ego,
that.
Yeah, including everything. Ego is one of the attractors, kind of. It's we're all in this game of this attractor. And you dissolve it, and then you wander around, and you can never give it names. You know, afterwards you try to describe to your friends what you saw. You know, you have certain words for it, but you can never fully describe
it. That's why you end up saying, whoa, dude. And that's it. That's how you can get out, right? Okay, so there are two frogs, both like sitting near each other, and they can hear each other croaking, right? And so in some sense, they're communicating because they can transmit audio signals to each other. But do they have a subjective sense of self? Or how digital can they be?
So I believe every animal that lives in community, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, that all animals live in community, but maybe, I mean, they have to mate at least to keep surviving. So there's some source of community. Then they have digital messages. Usually it's very simple, like enemy versus friend. You know, there are these communities that have signal for an enemy versus friend, or they have food versus no food, or come here or go away. You know, it's very simple digital messages that they convey between themselves. It's a denervated language, but it's kind of a language because it has a limit.
And in that case, the signal is always tied directly to the world issue at hand, the food, the escape, so it's almost like a sign. It's not a symbol. It's a digitized sign.
Yes. If I have to gamble, I think our language also evolved in this way. We first, you know, let's say we go to hunt together and we say, oh, elephant or something, you know, we point to things in order to calibrate. We didn't talk about our mental pain to each other. We talk about things outside. And then later on, that same language is attempting to describe things inside and gets this barrier of getting into the subjective experience, which we don't have a way to get there, basically. Not from inside, probably not from science, like using, you know, scientific tools to try to get there. Probably this is also a lost game. So we use our language, which is oriented towards outside. You know, we have a subject, action, object, what is the, in English it goes? So yeah, the basic sentence is very simple. Okay, you have a subject and predicate. So it's, I do something to something. Okay, I see something or I hit on something. This is the language. Evolve and become complex, etc. But when you try to reflect it back to the owner of the language, then you get lost. It was not created for this, or did not evolve for this, or we need more stages of evolution in order to, or different language to talk about the internal events, the subjective experiences.
So those two frogs have a sort of rudimentary form of digitization, because all animals that communicate or live in some sort of social...
Yeah. I believe this is a prediction. This is actually kind of a prediction that every animal that lives in a society must have a digital form of communication.
So let's come kind of full circle here and get back. Let's end on where you're headed and how you're continuing to advance in terms of, I mean, are you looking at the interactions between these reversed order hierarchical loops in the brain? What's next for you?
Yeah. So, okay. So if I could do everything I want, both experimentally and, lab resources, et cetera, I would go for this interaction of the BB and the BW domains.
What do you look for?
Let's put it this way. So this is a big mystery, what happens there.
Yeah.
If I had the resources to do it, maybe then I would stop and ask, okay, what actually I ask? What is the actual question about there? Because the prediction about the BWBB story goes beyond that. I don't have to go to the brain. I can look at societies and interaction between people, etc. At coevolution. To actually, I think now when you pose this question, is that maybe the most important, I add one. One important mission is to understand AI, understand where AI take us, or where are we letting it to take us, and where we should be limited. This is something that, the regulators do not do, the society doesn't do. Engineers from here and there raise flags, red flags, to say, look, Hinton raised the flags. Look, we are in a danger, but nobody pay attention. So this is one one thing to put energy in. And the second, maybe what you mentioned, the BWBB balance. This is very intriguing to say, okay, now that we can quantify it, we can track it even, by following the dynamics of perception in different conditions. Let's see how we make it easier instead of, tedious sessions of meditations that you do and get a little bit, how to do it easier. I remember the Dalai Lama, he addressed at some SFN meeting. He was a speaker, plenary speaker.
I remember this. If you could take a pill, he would.
Give me the pill. And I said, come on. Yeah. Okay, maybe this is the way to go. Not the pill, but the dynamics that can make it easier, make the meditation easier to change the balance.
Okay. All right. So we have discovered a business venture for us to collaborate on, a pill for BBBW balance. That's good.
Yep,
that's good. Anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to discuss?
You had a wonderful list. Probably we didn't cover half of it, but I think we covered many, many things.
I was just kind of looking at what I sent you, and it really, I think we kind of, oh, yeah, I could ask, here's what I'll ask you, if you're willing to listen to it. You do mention Hofstadter and his idea of the strange loop.
Yes.
Is your version strange loops plural, or how do you think of the strange loop with respect to your account of these hierarchical loops?
Okay, so I wrote to Hofstadter at one point and told him, look, we discovered your strange loop here. And he said, very strange email, like lines that you cannot read. He said, okay, I wish you, very interesting, I wish you luck, something like this.
he didn't engage in it?
No, did not engage.
Oh, he's like super worried that AI is like, it's here, right? And which is interesting, because he was sort of a skeptic for, throughout, like, the AI is never going to get to the point where we have to worry about it. And now he's like, whoa, it's here.
So maybe, I tell you what, his strange loop is, the AI do not have his strange loops, but our brains do, in the way that I started to describe before, that they said the process that you start to ask about how the digital information gets to the ear. So the idea, the strange loop is here. You, if you imagine the signals coming, and there's no beginning and no end to the story, although I start somewhere. Okay. So I start at the peripheral signal. It comes to the inner ear. You have activation. You have these loops going and transforming the signals until they get an attractor of the world chair. And then these attractors feed back to the ear. This is not a hypothesis. In hearing, unlike in vision and somatosensation, these loops are not well studied. And I know that many auditory experts object this view, but this is my view. The anatomy is there. And then the question is how you interpret it. So the anatomy says the signals go to the outer hair cells, and then now they control the way that you hear the next phoneme or the next word. Okay, I started with the chair, with my accent, etc., and immediately you have this prediction of the next one. You even have it before because your knowledge, as we said, because like LLM, we learn how to predict the next word. And now you start off. So what happens? You went up and up and up in the brain W ladder from the sensory organ, the brainstem, thalamus, cortex, and the next level is the ear again. The next level up is the ear again. This is the strange loop of Hofstetter and Escher. But so you get back to the same physical point, but you are more advanced in the mental domain because you now know more. So you kind of, you have a spiral that goes through the physical and mental and gets the mental, well, physical remains the same. You go again against the same physical domain, but the mental gets more and more advanced until you understand what I said.
Okay. All right. Ehud. I really have enjoyed learning. Well, I've enjoyed our conversation after having enjoyed reading the work, and I'm glad that we connected it actually. And it helped me understand a little bit better Mike Shadlin's accounts of like reportability and consciousness, and they are related. I'm still going to think about how
They're not identical. I forget now exactly what was the point. I wrote to him and never answered. They told me I never answer emails, but
so
Mike, if you listen, write to me. We have to figure out this difference. There is a difference.
Okay, Doug. Okay, Mike, get back to Ehud. He's got ideas.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, this was a lot of fun. So thanks for taking the time with me.
Thanks a lot, Paul. It was wonderful. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Brain Inspired is powered by The Transmitter, an online publication that aims to deliver useful information, insights, and tools to build bridges across neuroscience and advance research. Visit thetransmitter.org to explore the latest neuroscience news and perspectives written by journalists and scientists. If you value Brain Inspired, support it through Patreon to access full-length episodes, join our Discord community, and even influence who I invite to the podcast. Go to braininspired.co to learn more. The music you hear is a little slow jazzy blues performed by my friend, Kyle Donovan. Thank you for your support. See you next time.